Well, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for having me. It's a real honor to be asked to speak. And I've spoken here one time before, and I like it because you're a smart and challenging audience, so I'm really excited. We, SCIC, I work at Saskatchewan Council for International Cooperation, and SCIC had hosted a food forum, a food security, food sovereignty forum in November. And basically, we're looking at global issues surrounding food in the world. So it was a really, really great event. I don't know if any of you were able to come to it. It was in Saskatoon, unfortunately, but we had Francis Moore LaPay, who wrote Diet for a Small Planet and has written like 18 other books, and she's this visionary thinker. And she was there, so she was our keynote. And then the next day we had workshops. So some were informational workshops, and then some were sort of solutions-based workshops, because it doesn't do you any good to have a bunch of information without knowing how you can, you know, actually make a difference. So this is coming out of this conference. It's sort of a report back of what was said at the conference. So I'm going to go through the different aspects of things that people learned. It was really well attended. We had, over 100 people on both days, so it was really well attended. Everyone really raved about it, so it was a really great success. The thing is that people want more. You know, they always want you to do a second annual, or, you know, they want more. They always want more, and it's like, how do you give people more? You know, it's, I guess that's the big constraint with a nonprofit organization is, you know, well, there's only so much money, there's only so many resources and stuff, so it's like, how do you actually follow up on it? But I am able to follow up on it right now, so I'm really excited. So this first picture, it's actually not really picture heavy, sorry, it's more text heavy, this presentation, but this is a picture of a seed saving center in the Global South. And it's really, really exciting to think of all the work that people are doing in the Global South to save seeds and how important seeds are for humanity. Did anybody see Chris Hedges when he was here? Yeah, wow, what a talk. Like, it really, and he's just such an amazing guy. And so this is a quote of his that I wanted to start with. So we'll talk about what's actually happening in the world. So a billion people do not have enough to eat. So that's 1 in 7. So in this room, that would be a few of us that would be hungry. 98% of these people live in developing countries. Women make up a little over half of the world's population, but they account for over 60% of the world's hungry. 1 out of 6 children is underweight, and 1 in 4 of the world's children are stunted. And stunting means brain damage. So lack of nutrition causes brain damage, and it's amazing to me that, you know, the powers that be would create a world where people are being born with brain damage, or, you know, suffering brain damage. It makes no sense to me. Like, these are the world's leaders, the next leaders of the world. So we'll talk a little bit about the causes of the global food crisis. Now, these are, I don't know, has anybody heard of ETC Group, Etc. Group? It's this gentleman named Pat Mooney, and he's this wonderful, again, a visionary who has been working to really expose the concentration of power. With the Occupy movement and the 99%, we've actually, you know, learned in the public sphere about the concentration of wealth and power. Well, this is what these people do. They expose the concentration of land and wealth and power and technology. So, erosion. Genetic erosion, erosion of species, soils, and the atmosphere, the erosion of knowledge, and the global erosion of rights. So some implications of erosion, there's loss of habitat and diversity through monocropping, and where there used to be thousands of varieties of potatoes and apples and everything else, now there's, you know, 10, say, meaning that there's less resistance to climate change and pests and disease with a lack of diversity. And the loss of pollinators, which people may have heard of colony collapse disorder, where the pollinators that pollinate all of our food. I actually looked up a list of the food that bees pollinate, and it was just this long, and I was going to try and put it on here, this long, long list of foods that bees pollinate, but Yeah, so the erosion of diversity, and that would be cultural and, you know, physical. And technology, so things like genetic engineering, Terminator seeds, where seeds can't, if you plant them, they won't reproduce, and traitor seeds, so if it starts out as one plant, it becomes a different plant when you plant it again, so you don't know exactly what you're going to get. And then the patenting of genes, biological warfare, nanotechnology. And so this kind of really super high technology that's making a really huge impact on the Earth that no one really knows much about. And then concentration. So that was where the concentration of power, the concentration of economic power in the hands of high-tech global oligopolies, including corporate concentration, intellectual property, and patents. So I think we're all familiar with this idea of the concentration of power, and this is pretty much the main problem when it comes to food, is the concentration of life in the hands of a few. So this is a graph. So the top 10 corporations, so the most powerful top 10 corporations in the world have 55% of the share of pharmaceuticals, 89% of agrochemicals, 66% of biotech, 63% of animal pharma. They're 26% of the processors of food and beverage, 40% of groceries, and 67% of seeds. So it gives you an idea of, you know, more than half of, you know, pretty much everything we use in our life is in the hands of 10 corporations. As far as seeds go, 67% of all the seeds belong to the top 10. So Monsanto, DuPont, Bayer, and the world's top 10 pesticide firms have 90% of control of the pesticides in the world. Again, Potash Corp actually is one of the top fertilizer companies. But it's this concentration of control over the food that we grow and eat that is of concern to us today and every day. So part of corporate agriculture is the use of chemicals. So it's not organic farming or seeds that have been selected over generations that are being used to produce food for local consumption. It's massive tracts of land producing food by small farmers too, but by corporations where mainly they want you to use their inputs. They want you to use their fertilizers, their chemicals, their seeds, and that gives them control over the food. So that is, and so some of the implications of this is they're really, really expensive. I mean, farmers here, gas, most of the chemicals are also made up of gas and oil. So we know how expensive oil and gas is getting. So basically, the price is going way up. So it's really, really hard for you probably know farmers or are farmers and how expensive it is to grow food. But it's because of these, inputs from chemical companies. So, also, chemicals really cause a lot of problems in nature. So, you can look at maps of the world where it shows where all the runoff from the agriculture is going, and all the coastlines are pretty much dead zones now because of all the chemicals that are running off. So, like in Lake Winnipeg is dying. That's this because Manitoba produces a ton of food, but all of the chemicals are going into the lake and it's killing the lakes and the oceans. So, the chemicals are really, they're bad for humans as well, just in terms of consuming them. So there's a lot of problems for humans and nature with chemicals, as well as debt problems. And I put farmer suicides on here because farmer suicides are rampant. Like, there's so many farmer suicides, and they don't really talk about it so much in Canada, although I believe that it's happening. But in India, famously, they're drinking the pesticides to die. And that's, it's an epidemic of people not being able to live on the land. So there's the four ABCD, the four multinational agribusiness, Archer Daniels Midland, Sponge, Cargill, ConAgra, and Louis Dreyfus, which, again, we may not know, like, they would produce the food that we all eat, we just wouldn't know it, because there's no, they don't provide information on labels, so there's no way to know who's actually doing it, unless you do a lot of research, but that is also, they don't have to tell you what they're doing, because it's intellectual property, so that's another big issue when it comes to, like, concentration of information, is that we don't have the information we need to make choices that are good for us and the Earth, because they don't have to tell us. So there's no freedom of information. Now, has anybody familiar with the great global land grab? Like, does that, like, the land grabbing? And so what's happening now, because there is, I mean, it's happening for a lot of reason, but since the early 2000s, there's been a massive wave of investment in farmland. So many of these deals are negotiated. They're just, it's basically, I mean, it would be different in every situation, but they'd either take the land, like remove the people and take the land, which, I mean, corporations have been doing that forever, like banana plantations and, you know, all different kinds of food production. But in this case, they're taking the land without consultation from the people. And people are losing their right, their right to their land. So this is a map. So all the red areas are who is buying the land, and then the green areas are where the land is being bought up. So basically, land that was in production for local food or for export is now owned by, say, the U.S. or China or, you know, whoever, to, and then instead of people being able to buy or produce food for their own production or for export to get money, now the land is owned by a foreign company. And that is happening here majorly in Saskatchewan. They are selling off the land to foreign interests like crazy. So once you have control of the land and you have control of the food, it's, you know, you have a lot of control. And plus, and that, you know, is linked to the high price of food. So who's doing it? So it's governments, corporations, and investment funds, private investors, agribusiness companies, of course, and financial interests. And then the World Bank is getting in on it too. So it's not, it's, some of it is for actual, like China, for example, they want land so they can produce food so they can feed their people because there's so many people. Whereas some of them are just buying land and speculating, and it's just for money. It's just for, it's the, you know, the casino of the stock market. It's so they can just speculate and buy and sell land and just have control, so that it's really just a profit-making venture. It's not even about food. And that's one of the saddest things about the global land grab, is that it's not even about food. It's about money. Well, I mean, the whole thing, I guess, is about money, about profit, making profit. So basically, this is leading to a lot of volatility and increased prices for food. And we've seen that, like, that's what they say started the Arab Spring, was the high food prices. And they're saying there's food riots linked to the high cost of food. And so it is a serious business that, you know, food is being treated as a commodity instead of as a right, you know, as something that people need to live and that should be provided for them. You know, it's being treated as a commodity to buy and sell on the market so that people can get rich. Or just have control over others, too. So what's happening is the dispossession and marginalization of rural people and farmers and indigenous people. Land tenure rights, people who've had this land for, you know, generations now have, they've lost their land. There's less access to land for food, so people aren't able to produce food. And then there's a gender injustice component here, because a lot of the small farmers are women, and they typically don't have, you know, access to land or money or whatever. They're not, you know, it's not their right to have land. So this global land grabbing is specifically hurting women more than it is men, and also because women mainly are the subsistence farmers and they produce the food for the family. So for them to lose the land, it's a double impact on them. So we've had instances of conflict and human rights abuses, and in general, a loss of food sovereignty. And I mean, I guess you could compare that to what's happening with First Nations in Canada, where, you know, traditional land has been taken away for profit. And so sovereignty, your land sovereignty, or, you know, generational access to land is being taken away. And then ethical implications for the North, because mainly it's, you know, northern corporations that are doing it. So really, in a way, it comes down to, you know, ethics and morals of what we're actually doing here. And have people heard about biofuels or agrofuels? So they're taking a lot of the land and producing food to make fuel. So that's one of the other main reasons for the super high increase in food prices. So instead of using corn for food, they're using corn for cars and trucks. It's just, it's so ironic to me, but it's one of the hugest, because there's a food, peak oil, we've reached peak oil, there's food shortages of oil and gas. They're desperate to keep the oil and gas system running, and they're using food to do it. So that is one of the main reasons for the food crisis today. So there's less food available, and, you know, it's causing riots, and people are upset. Meat is always a topic that, you know, people get a little concerned about, to say that, you know, they want to eat meat or they have to eat meat for health and that sort of thing. So meat, a third of the cropland is used for animal feed. It takes 3 kilograms of grain to produce 1 kilogram of meat, 16,000 liters of water per kilogram of meat. And the non-food use of cereals is enough to feed 4.35 billion people. And then there's also the issue of factory farms, which a lot of our meat, I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with eating meat that's locally produced, but it doesn't exist in the scale that we need it. And we all have known about XL Foods and the troubles and the recalls of meat and how frightening it must be for meat eaters to, you know, feed their families, in my mind. I mean, it's not only meat, it is spinach and vegetables and other things. It's not just meat. It's the sort of the agribusiness of food that is causing poison food, which is harming humans. So, climate change. Agriculture also is really, really affecting climate change. So, there has been widespread droughts and increased flooding. So, I read this article about, like, there was 63% of crop failure in the U.S. this last year. Like, that's not good. That's not good at all. So, there's a lot of drought, a lot of crops are failing. And then there's a lot of flooding, which, you know, we've experienced that in Saskatchewan and may experience it again. So there's flooding and droughts that's happening. Grain stockpiles. We have less grain. Like, we're in a food crisis in the sense that we used to have stockpiles of food. So when there was food shortages, we'd have food to you know, put into the system. Those stockpiles are gone. Irrigation, almost impossible now because of the lack of water in the aquifers. And then the grain production being diverted to biofuels. So the food system produces 29% of the greenhouse gas emissions as it's currently done. It doesn't have to, but it does. In like sort of global agribusiness causes tons of greenhouse gas emissions. And then increased uncertainty and unpredictability. Like I have at work, we do overseas projects. And so when farmers used to plant in March, now they can't plant until May, and then instead of the season being 6 months, it's only 4 months, and then the crops don't grow. Like, it's really, like, and people have no idea. Like, they know the land, like, the back of their hand. They know exactly what's going on. They know what seeds to plant, when to plant, and how to survive in really austere conditions. But no more. Those days are over. They have no idea when the rainy season's coming, when it's gonna end, and what's gonna happen. So there's so much uncertainty now is another factor. Now this is, obviously you probably can't read the chart and it doesn't really matter, but the point is to say that because of the way agriculture, like, for example, Saskatchewan produces, you know, most of the world's lentils, most of the world's mustard seeds, you know. So we produce it here, it goes somewhere else and gets processed, and then maybe it comes back or where it goes, wherever it is. So it's that kind of, and I'm not opposed to trade, don't get me wrong. I love to eat things from other parts of the world, for sure. But it's the way it's done so inefficiently that it's all the transportation and packaging and processing and factories and all that kind of, like, the how the agribusiness food system works, that it is so, it's really, really bad for the environment, and it's causing, it's really impacting climate change as well. So there's agriculture, transport, processing, packaging, transport, retail, transport, consumption. Like, it's really a complex system. Now, it's fine to say, you know, we'll get to the things that we can do on an individual level, but really what it is what governments need to do. Governments do a lot of things. It's not like governments don't do anything. They do a lot. They subsidize, you know, oil and gas. They subsidize bankers. They do a lot of subsidizing of other things, but they have a problem with subsidizing food. So nothing will change unless government changes as well. It has to happen at every level. So increasing local food production in urban areas. Like, for example, Calgary has a food security strategy. Like, we don't have that. North America doesn't have that. The world doesn't have it. Nobody has it. Nobody's prepared, you know. Calgary has a, you know, has a plan. And I'm hoping that, you know, in Regina we can get that too. Subsidies for food production. And I wouldn't even call them subsidies. It's just, you know, it's an investment in a human right, essentially. Increase productivity of existing farmland, so changing the way we do farming. Ecologically sound intensification practices, integrated pest management and protection of pollinators, and appropriate technology. So putting money into, like, I always think about when, like, those technology shows when they have these, like, crazy technologies, and I think, but who gets to use that? Like, what good is it? I guess it's interesting, but technology is only good if it, you know, everybody, it benefits everybody in my mind. Like, let's make technology that benefits everybody and then move on to the high level stuff that, where it's some video game that everyone thinks is great. Like, I don't really understand myself, but. Okay. So the World Food Program calculates that $3.2 billion is needed per year to reach all 66 million hungry school-aged children. $3.2 billion? Like, basically that's nothing when you think about it. It seems like a lot, but really? So subsidies to oil and gas and the military and banks. I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what the subsidies are to those industries. And, you know, when the bailout happened and they gave $7 billion to the banks in the U.S. and they gave a lot of money in Canada as well, you know, it's like, why couldn't you come up with that money for HIV/AIDS or for water or for, you know, it's like, they were like, oh, we can't afford that. Well, you can afford some, you know, it's all about priorities. What do you want to be able to afford, essentially? Now, this is, I have this on a handout, actually, because in my mind, it's like the dream. It's the dream. It's like what we want. If we could have anything in the world for food, this would be what we want. So I'll hand it out to you and you can take it home. And, you know, maybe, you know, contemplate what could be. But this is to say that people are fighting back in the world. There's so many people, like the Via Campesina. So Campesina or peasant, they've gotten together. So it's 148 organizations, and they appear at every trade talk, and you know, and not only that, but they're working together, which is the most exciting thing, to have all of these countries working together, because, you know, we're so divided. No, they're coming together, and they're working for the rights of people, of peasants, of the environment. So this is a really good handout, so I'll give that to you later. So the Via Campesina is an example of, like, true hope. And then there's the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil. So same thing, they basically occupy the land and grow food, because all it is these, again, it was like the land grabbing from way back, that people just took these huge plantations and then didn't put them into production. They just let them lie fallow And meanwhile, the peasants were kicked off the land, had no way to grow food, and people were hungry. So this has been going on for a long time. It's a really exciting movement for food sovereignty. The slow food movement, has anybody heard of slow food? So yeah, so basically the way I think of it is like it's artisan food in a way. So instead of mono food, like say Velveeta, just to put it out there, it's like one food that is produced in one way, it tastes the same. Slow food would be, you know, what animals eat in the hills of Italy and how that would impact, and then how the artisans make the food and how that would impact the taste of the food. So it takes you back to like really tasting food and enjoying food and really respecting and honoring the farmers that made it with the skills that they have. So that's kind of what slow food is. And it's the opposite of fast food. You know, it's anti-agribusiness, anti-monoculture, and pro-diversity. So it's a big movement. It's also really exciting. Now, in Brazil, the government instituted a program called Zero Hunger. And basically, they've basically just said, we're going to, so some of the things they did, they have a food card so people can get food. They have direct financial aid, water cisterns, low-cost restaurants, educating people with healthy eating habits, distributing vitamins and iron supplements, and supporting subsistence family farming. So poverty in Brazil is down by 25%, and that's in a decade. So that shows you that it's possible. It's totally possible. It's all a matter of priorities, and, you know, I guess in a way it's an ethical or moral imperative as well. It's like, who do you want to support? Other things that are happening, community-supported agriculture. Who's a part of a community-supported agriculture here? Yeah. Community gardens. Urban agriculture is getting really, really big. Farmers markets, CD Saturdays, the fair trade movement. And worldwide, more people are members of co-ops than own shares in publicly traded companies. So co-ops are huge for this, for food justice. So, that's really exciting. And then the other thing is citizens participating in decision-making. When we talked about the ABCD earlier, they go to trade talks, and they say what they want. And laws, like, there's like 17 lobbyists per government official in the States, and here I'm sure it's the same. So you can't underestimate the power of lobbying and public relations and how it makes it seem like it's okay, but really it's not. So there's so much decision making being made by corporations, and citizens aren't a part of that conversation. So a lot of it is just getting citizens to actually be able to say what they want. Now, things we can do. So watch what you consume. The average food item travels thousands of kilometers before it reaches our plates. Buy local and plant a garden. Eat less meat and buy local organic meat. Cook with whole foods. Read labels. Host a potluck and spend our money wisely. So supporting local organic producers, not multinationals, and tell them why we are not buying their food. And so these are some, this is a lot of this. The Food and Agriculture Organization special rapporteur on the right to food came to Canada. Did anybody hear about that? So he's a UN guy. He came to Canada and he went around the country to look at, you know, how we're doing on food. Mostly he works in the Global South, but he decided to come to Canada. Wow. The government really dissed him. They basically said that his report was false and how dare he even say that, and they really dissed what he said. It was really embarrassing. And then all the food organizations in Canada like asked the government to apologize to the special rapporteur, and it was this big scandal. So anyway, he came to Canada. Not good news. Grain.org is really good. The organization Grain and Oxfam. And they work on, like, they're working on getting behind it. Because how are we supposed to know this stuff? Like, how do we know? There's no way to know, really. It's like the PR is so smart that there's no way for us to really actually know what's going on. But these organizations know. They're paying attention. They're keeping track. And so it's important to support, or just to read up on it, to learn about different things that are happening. And this is the last slide, and it's basically respecting the knowledge of people in the Global South who have worked for centuries and have produced food. And, you know, what we're here to do is to say that we need to stand up for our food rights, because they're being taken away by multinationals and by governments. And a lot of it is to get your voice out there, you know, use your dollars, support organizations, support farmers, talk to your friends. Everything you eat, imagine, you know, where it came from and what the impacts of it were. And by doing that, we can improve the food system. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Denise. I'm sure there are questions after that presentation.
Thank you. That was most interesting, if not happy. Anyway, first of all, I just wanted to ask again, the organization that you work for
is SCIC, so Saskatchewan Council for International Cooperation.
That isn't a government talk.
Well, we're funded by the government for now. The sector is really under threat. A lot of our members lost. We have 70 members. We're part of an intercouncil network. There's 7 councils across the country. We have hundreds and hundreds of members of organizations doing international development work. A lot of our members lost funding. They did a new call for proposals, which is what they do. So you can do a call for proposals. And they went to mining companies in the private sector. That's where the money's going. So the taxpayers' money, instead of going to nonprofits and churches and social justice organizations, is going to mining companies. So they're really partnering with the private sector. They're doing like small projects, like 2-year projects, instead of what in the past we've been doing is program funding over, you know, decades to actually do development. And so the people who have current funding, they're losing their funding, and a lot of people that I've worked with over the years are losing their jobs, and like, it's very tragic to know. But it's civil society. It's basically silencing any opposition to government is what's happening. So
yeah, I was having a sense of that, and I was thinking how good it would be if the MLAs and so forth were in a room with you with this information. And I know the information is out there in other forms, but this is quite a very concise look in a few words, really, of an enormous body of information. And anyway, I just wanted to understand what the connection was between this organization, because it had Saskatchewan at the beginning. I was thinking, I know it can't be a government organization because they wouldn't let you say this. But I was thinking, boy, it would sure be good if we, you know, if this sort of presentation would be made. And I think there are lots of people here who support these ideas. And, you know, for those of us who do, to ensure that that the voice of this organization is heard is important.
Well, another thing is, like, in terms of concentration, is the concentration of information, but like the concentration of the press, so the media, so radio and TV, like, it's all really, it's basically a propaganda machine for corporations now. So it's not free press. It's really hard to get. I mean, I love CBC, don't get me wrong, but, you know, their funding is under threat as well. So that's what I'm saying about, you know, any voices of resistance that are being silenced through government spending, through priorities. Like, you're going to give money to oil and gas, but you're not going to give money to overseas development. Like, it's just against, you know, like, contracts, I guess you could say, that you've made at the international level with the United Nations and with all other countries, developing or developed countries, the G8 countries, like, you know, it's promises that were made at that level and treaties that were signed on to. So it's not like, really, I mean, you don't really have a choice, you know, like, I mean, yeah, we backed out of Kyoto, but that was an international agreement. Like, we're embarrassing ourselves on the international stage, really, by going against everything that the international community has come up with. We're basically dissing everything that has been decided upon by the international community.
Well, it seems that the World Trade Organization and these 10 companies that you're talking about and so forth, they wrote the trade agreements. Those are our international agreements, too.
Yeah.
Those people wrote the agreements and then got governments to sign them. It didn't go the other way around. And anyway, keeping these organizations, the non-governmental organizations, in contact with each other and as strong as possible, I suppose, is what we need to be doing.
Yeah, civil society movement building. And, you know, that was the thing that Frances Morlepay said that most stuck out in my head. Well, one, she said to be brave and to actually just do stuff. Actually be brave and say things. Like you say, I felt afraid to say some things or do some things because for fear of, like, losing our funding, you know? But she basically said, like, get corporations or get money out of politics. Like, that was her main thing. And she's American, fair enough. But it was those lobbyists that, you know, are paid off, or essentially those people are in power, but that's what she said, is to get money out of politics. And it was so, I mean, that's huge. That's really huge. But it's so great. Like, that, it would really, really help if it was average citizens running the show instead of corporations running the show, essentially, people with money. So. Well, we like to remain hopeful. So.
Denise, hi.
Hello.
I feel very emotional about this because it's massive, right? It's all about what's happening worldwide with respect to the problems with trying to turn the tide on climate change. And we have a prime minister who says climate change doesn't exist. We have a prime minister whose background is in the oil industry and whose main focus is on making money and silencing any debates. So anybody who objects to the oil pipeline is then called a traitor to the country. I mean, he's very despicable. And so I think the worst thing we can have is apathy. And I think people have to work together. We're being sort of shunted off as individuals. And certainly we can do some individual work, like choose who we buy from and, you know, we can support local farmers, etc. I mean, there's also the big issue of population control. I know I'm going off in another direction, but, you know, it seems to me I totally support helping those who are alive now, and I give money to the food bank. And we need to do more about contraception and population control because, you know, we're feeding millions at the same time. Millions are having children when they can't afford to have children. So there are so many issues. But I think we here in the Unitarian Fellowship could have some kind of food action group. And we could organize to order meat or whatever from, I have connections with farmers. And we could be doing something as a group. We could also be doing something as a group as lobbyists, right? So.
Well, we have to. Like, that's the bottom line, is that it's being taken away from us. And there's so many, like, I think part of it is, like, that divide and conquer thing where it's, like, divide people and the individualism. And, I mean, that's, like, that's a corporate entity as well in terms of, you know, staying in your house and buying things individually and not being part of your community. And so that's part of the PR pitch, and it's so effective. I mean, these guys are geniuses, you know, it's really working on us. And just to say on the gender justice is that most, which, you know, maybe why this is why we're losing our funding, I don't know, but most development organizations now are working on rights, women's rights, and that part of women's rights is the right, reproductive rights. And so that is, you know, a really, really big part of what's happening in development, and people are beginning to understand that that's really, really important for to make the world better, is to have women have rights, because right now they don't. And, you know, it's a really, really hard struggle to change that. But they're doing it. They're totally doing it, and it's working. So it's exciting.
You mentioned trade agreements, and, you know, our government and a lot of Western governments are pushing trade deals. One of the biggest ones right now is called the Trans-Pacific Trade Deal. And these all have what is called Chapter 11, which allows any corporation that feels that government regulations deprive them of profit, they can sue the government. In other words, it's the company suing the government. The people who hear the agreement are not courts. They're panels set up by corporations. And Canada has had to pay millions of dollars in a few cases where they've been sued. And this, of course, if a government sets up regulations that prohibit certain additives to food or hormones or so forth, and a corporation loses money because of this, they can sue the government, and the government usually drops the regulations. It's, you know, it's a crisis situation we're talking about, and all the things you talk about. And, you know, if we don't do something, like Al says, it's not going to happen. It probably isn't unless we get off our butts. I mean, it is a crisis situation on all these things. And the other thing I'd like to say is people in our fellowship often consider what you have said to be a lecture. And it's not spiritual, but if this isn't spiritual, I don't know what is. You know, the fact that we're facing a crisis, and if we don't do something, the whole world is in serious trouble.
Well, it's like I said about the brain-damaged kid, which I bring that up a lot, and it doesn't go over well, really, but that's what it is. That's what it's coming down to, is to, like, physically harm human beings and nature. You know, that isn't, I don't think that's what we should be doing. And the one thing I will say on the trade talks is that the WTO, there's been so much resistance in the WTO that it basically doesn't function anymore. So it's kind of exciting. What's happening now, Canada can't, they can't get their stuff done through the WTO. They can't bully all the countries in the Global South. The Global South is saying, no, we're not signing on to these. We've signed on to them. We've been harmed. We're not doing it anymore. So basically, the WTO is not really functioning anymore, which is exciting. But what they're doing instead is they're just doing the country. So it'll be, we have a trade deal with Colombia, and we have a trade deal with, you know, just individual countries, because they can't get these big things to go through, except the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And the thing about that, again, is, like, it's the erosion of knowledge, is that they're all done in secret. There's no democracy. It's like democracy is under threat. No one knows what they say. No one's allowed to know what they say. You know, that's the other thing, the control of information. No one will ever be able to read that agreement. No one will ever know, because they don't have to tell us, which is absolutely ridiculous. Like, we need, like, that's not part of democracy. As citizens, we have a right. Like, they don't run the show. Like, they work on behalf of us. Like, we are the people, and they work on behalf of us. That's what democracy is. Not, they work on behalf of corporations, and we don't get to know, and it totally affects our lives. Like, that's just not democracy. So our democracy is under threat, which sounds, you know, big, but it's true. And there wasn't democracy before. Like, we fought for everything we've done, we fought for, you know? Like, somebody fought for union rights for me, and somebody fought for, you know, so many different things that I have at my pleasure. And so we can't just because we have them now doesn't mean they can't be lost, because no one gave them to us. We fought for them. And we have to keep fighting for them. And there's more of us than there is of them, too. So
appreciate your talk and the information. I'm going to ask a quick little question, but I think what boils down to what I'm hearing in the discussion and what we all can participate in is the fact of, it's about information and education. The key to women's power worldwide is to educate the women. Wherever the women are getting education they couldn't get a decade ago, things are changing. Places like Brazil are changing. Why? There's way more women that are in government and involved in all aspects of that. But I want to get it back to a thing, and this is just a curiosity. How many people here use camelina oil? How many people have heard of camelina oil? Okay, well, good. Yep, got a few. It's a product in Saskatchewan. Camelina is an ancient grain. It's called Three Farmers Brand. It's available at Old Fashioned Foods. It's available at the Italian Deli, and it may be available other places. It is three farmers in Saskatchewan who've created a new product from an ancient grain. They're trying, I'm not sure if they succeeded in this yet, but they want their own cold pressing plant so they can be like the Italian olive farmer who has his own cold-pressed olive oil of the highest quality in the world and sells it for that reason. It costs more than other oils, but it's a Saskatchewan product by innovative Saskatchewan farmers, and we don't know about it because the system won't promote that. The grocery stores, if it could get in there, they have to pay huge shelving prices, and it'll be down at the bottom or at the back where people don't look and all that sort of thing. It's only specialty stores that carry it. And that's how ignorant we're kept. It's information, education, and sharing. This is very important.
Well, that's PR firms working for Roundup Ready canola that make sure that camelina isn't known about. Like, it's intentional, you know? And it's the PR. It's PR. I think it's all about PR. Or pulling the wool over your eyes. One of the two.
I think that the hour is getting to be a bit advanced this morning, and I'm hoping that Denise will stick around to carry on the discussion afterwards. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank her very much for a wonderful presentation this morning.
Thank you. Thank you.
I guess I also wanted to point out that the last slide was the Unitarian Service Committee of Canada, their Seeds of Survival program. I just put in that plug.